This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 5th of May, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast. On Capitol Hill, House Republicans push forward bills to expand offshore drilling, but Democrats are fighting back with efforts to repeal subsidies for the oil and gas industry. We go to South Florida, where environmentalists are fighting efforts by a biotech company to expand into sensitive areas. And we continue our look at the future of US foreign policy following the death of Osama bin Laden. Today we go to Lahore to learn more about what questions Pakistanis are asking. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Open borders in Europe's Schengen zone could be closed following an influx of migrants fleeing the recent unrest in northern Africa. The Schengen zone is made up of 25 European countries, but operates like a single state with no internal border controls. FSRN's Hermione G. reports from Amsterdam.
Under pressure from France and Italy, the European Commission in Brussels unveiled a proposal Wednesday to reintroduce border controls in emergency situations. European countries could temporarily impose passport control if any Schengen member fails to adequately patrol its part of the zone's external border. After a wave of immigrants from Libya and Tunisia entered Italy, the country issued 25,000 residence permits, allowing the North Africans free movement throughout the open border zone. Concerned that most of the French-speaking Tunisian migrants would head for France, the French government temporarily closed its main railway frontier with Italy and imposed tight controls on people crossing into France. EU Home Affairs Commissioner Cecilia Maelstrom said that under the new proposal, any additional border controls would be very limited and subject to strict rules. Refugee organizations in some EU member states have expressed their concern that the new rules could be used to further anti-immigrant policies within the Schengen zone. The proposal will be considered by European Home Affairs ministers on May 12th. Hermione G., FSRN, Amsterdam.
After a year-long manhunt for the person or persons responsible for a bombing at a Jacksonville, Florida mosque, the FBI says they have shot and killed their prime suspect. Law enforcement found Florida resident Sandlin Smith in a remote area of Oklahoma. During the raid, Smith allegedly pulled out a gun and was shot by FBI agents. The crime, which caused damage but no injuries at the mosque, was being investigated as a possible hate crime. The FBI affidavit says Smith admitted bombing the mosque to multiple people and had also told witnesses he didn't like Muslims. Students and parents in Tucson are waiting today to hear when the city's unified school district will make a decision regarding its ethnic studies classes. The district wants to make some Mexican-American humanities classes electives rather than core curriculum. The move shifts the district into closer compliance with a state law banning ethnic studies classes in public schools. The proposal raised the ire of many students, parents, and community members. A decision was expected on Tuesday night, but delayed after concerned residents packed the meeting, demanding time to speak. Police forcibly removed several from the meeting. The district told FSRN it is currently deciding in what form an additional public forum should take place. The criminal trial in the largest human trafficking case in U.S. history continues this week. Of the eight people charged in the case, two have now pleaded guilty. FSRN's Larry Geller has this update from Hawaii.
The case involves approximately 400 Thai workers allegedly recruited by Global Horizons Manpower, Inc., a California firm headed by Mordecai Orion, the principal defendant in the federal case. The second defendant to plead guilty, Shane German, appeared in Honolulu Federal Court Wednesday. German admitted he confiscated the passports of Thai workers in Hawaii, preventing them from leaving their farms. He also said he was ordered to confine workers on the property. German said that he did this under the orders of Orion. Instead of a possible 30-year prison term, German's plea agreement reduces the maximum sentence to 5 years in prison, plus fines and restitution to the Thai workers. The information provided by German and another defendant is expected to bolster the case against Mordecai Orion when it comes to trial. Larry Geller, FSRN, Honolulu.
And finally, the first Republican presidential hopeful debate is tonight in Greenville, South Carolina. But several news agencies are boycotting because of limits on photographer access put in place by Fox News and the South Carolina Republican Party, who are co-sponsoring the event. No still photographers will be allowed in the room during the debate. The Associated Press says it will not cover the event in any way. Politico reports that Reuters will not offer photographic coverage. The debate may not ultimately yield much insight into the Republican candidates because many of the early buzz generators, including Sarah Palin and Mitt Romney, won't be participating. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Yemen today, government officials say two al-Qaeda members were killed. Video footage from the scene in Shabwa province shows a burned-out car, and some witnesses and tribal officials suspect a U.S. drone fired a missile attack. The U.S. government has increased anti-terrorism activities in Yemen, where al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula operates, although officials do not confirm strikes from the CIA's unmanned Predator program. The attack comes days after the U.S. assassination of al-Qaeda's leader Osama bin Laden at a compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, and debate continues over what his death means for U.S. foreign policy in places like Yemen, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. For a view from Pakistan, we go to Junaid Ahmad, Professor of Law at Lahore University of Management Sciences. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Hello, yes, good to be with you.
What was your initial reaction when you heard the news that bin Laden had been assassinated?
I think like many Pakistanis throughout the country, the first reaction was one of bewilderment at the fact that Osama bin Laden was found in this heavily militarized garrison town of Abbottabad, where there's a large Pakistani military presence, and not in the caves or the mountains of northwestern Pakistan or Afghanistan. I think most Pakistanis will tell you that this was quite unbelievable. So there's a lot of skepticism here at the official narrative.
What sort of skepticism, and about what in particular in the narrative?
Well, I think there is one view that is questioning the fact whether Osama bin Laden was actually even killed on this day. That is, that he may have been killed much, much earlier, and that because there were no photographs and the body was removed from the country right away, that there may be something very suspicious in relation to this and quite mysterious. So that whether he was even there and that was his body that was supposedly killed and removed from the country. So there's that view on the one hand. And then there's, I think, just the skepticism at whether, in terms of the timing of all of this. That is, if bin Laden had been there, how long had he been there? What was he doing in a highly sensitive military area of Pakistan where it's quite incredulous that the military would not have known about it and the intelligence would not have known about it, and therefore that the American intelligence would not have known about it? So these are the types of questions people are asking.
You mentioned, of course, that bin Laden was found in the town Abbottabad and its very strong ties to the Pakistani military with its garrison, its military training college. What are members of the Pakistan military saying about that?
Well, this is where the competing claims since the incident itself have kind of been receiving, in fact, a lot of coverage now. Because in some ways, Obama set the tone from the beginning when he said that while he thanked the Pakistanis, he also made it clear that this was a solo operation by the American Special Forces and that, in fact, no intelligence sharing took place in this raid. Now, again, that's really hard to believe here locally because, again, this is not in the caves or the mountains of northwestern Pakistan, which is really a no man's land, but in the heart of a large military cantonment town, where the chief of army staff just visited last week. In fact, the Pakistani military and the government in general here is in fact walking quite a tightrope. I think on the one hand, it has served them to claim that this was solely a U.S. operation, so that domestic sentiment is not further angered here in Pakistan at the fact that once again the government has allowed Americans to come in, violate Pakistani national sovereignty, and undertake this action. So on the one hand, I think they're considering that, but on the other hand, the consequence of maintaining that type of silence on their collusion in this operation is that from Washington, D.C., and Congress members are already up in arms that, you know, why weren't the Pakistanis informing us of this? How long had Osama been here and the Pakistani military had known about it? So these types of questions, and I think this is why the military establishment here in Pakistan is walking quite a tightrope in judging what to actually say publicly and what not to say.
Has this changed the way that Pakistanis view their military, the fact that bin Laden has been assassinated on Pakistani soil?
We are speaking about a population here in Pakistan which over the past several years has developed a very great degree of anti-Americanism because of U.S. policy in the region, and especially the horrible drone attacks that violate Pakistani sovereignty. So I think they're very sensitive on these types of questions. But at the same time, they also don't want to portray themselves, that is the Pakistani military, as not being able to control such type of situations, and that in fact these situations where Americans can come in at their will cannot actually take place, and that indeed they would need to rely on the approval first of the Pakistani military before they could undertake such action. So I think they're caught between both of these ends.
You mentioned the U.S. drone campaign in Pakistan. What impact do you think the death of bin Laden will have, if any, on that campaign?
I think that the drone campaign is related to the larger expansion and intensification of the Afghan war into the so-called AFPAC theater and the expansion of the war into Pakistan. So I think for many analysts here, it doesn't seem like much will change. That is, that this may simply have been a big kind of PR spectacle put on for Obama's own domestic political purposes, and in terms of fundamental policy towards the region, we won't see a shift, which means then that two things, that of course drone attacks would continue, but also the real issue of the threat from radical militancy in the region, that won't subside, because in some ways that the policies won't change.
Junaid Ahmad, Professor of Law at Lahore University in Pakistan, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure to do it.
One of the code words used in the U.S. Special Forces operation that killed Osama bin Laden was Geronimo, and a growing chorus of voices say the U.S. government should apologize. Geronimo was a revered Apache tribal leader who fought for decades to save his people and land from attacks by U.S. and Mexican forces during the 19th century. At a hearing today on Capitol Hill, Senator Tom Udall from New Mexico said his office has tried to get clarification on how the military used the term Geronimo.
I find the association of Geronimo with bin Laden to be highly inappropriate and culturally insensitive. It highlights a serious issue, and the very issue we have come here to discuss today, a socially ingrained acceptance of derogatory portrayals of indigenous people.
Udall said the Defense Department would not release details about how the name Geronimo was used. Spokane tribe member and artist Charlene Teeters, whose relatives served in Iraq and Afghanistan, said regardless of intent, the association of bin Laden with an American Indian hero can have a profound impact.
How do we ask American Indians who served this nation in uniform, who have sacrificed life in defense of this nation, in so many wars, in so many places, and do so with dignity and honor and commitment? Is it possible at this moment of national triumph that the deepest insult was not delivered upon Al-Qaeda abroad, but to a small population here at home?
Today's hearing had been scheduled before the killing of bin Laden to address ongoing problems with racist stereotypes, including the use of offensive team names and mascots at schools. Chair of the Fort Sill Apache tribe, Jeff Hauser, wrote a letter to President Obama this week calling on his administration to right this wrong. Hauser said this action showed neither compassion toward Native Americans nor a change in the perception of them or an understanding of their struggle.
We know freedom is the answer. The only question is, who's next?
It's very bad for my government. I haven't food, I haven't anything. Me and my children, I will die today.
Time to push, we ain't falling back now. Time to fight, we are all we have now. Do you hear me calling out for backups?
When a pro-democracy movement took to the streets of the Arab world in December and January, many of its youth participants brought their change-inspiring music with them.
Weathering the storm, pleasure to be born. News media disseminated, heaven's gate, level of alarm. Third-person dictate, couldn't sever until dawn. 3 mil in the street, we will live in peace.
Nigerian musician Fela Kuti said that music is the weapon of the future, and the critical lyrics and homegrown beats of Arab hip-hop played their own role in the so-called Arab Spring uprisings. FSRN plans to produce a documentary on the connection between hip-hop and the Arab uprisings, but we need your help. Visit fsrn.org to find out how you can support this project, Arab Hip-Hop, a soundtrack to the Arab Spring. Today, US lawmakers are considering bills that Republicans hope will expand offshore oil drilling. The proposals anger many Democrats who are pushing tighter regulations following the disastrous BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico last year. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
If you're in your car right now, you're well aware that gas prices are soaring across the US. Republicans are trying to use this spike in prices to ramp up domestic oil drilling. Here's the chair of the Natural Resources Committee, Doc Hastings of Washington State.
The national average price of gasoline has gone up 10 cents in just the last week, and is now about a cent and a half nationally from $4 a gallon. By comparison, the price was $1.84 a gallon when President Obama was sworn into office.
A series of House GOP bills would force new drilling off the coast of Virginia, set timelines for Gulf drilling leases, and requires the Interior Department to approve leases more quickly, all non-starters for most Democrats. A year ago today, BP's spill in the Gulf of Mexico was 2 weeks into gushing millions of barrels of oil into the sea. Massachusetts Democratic Congressperson Ed Markey says that accident gave policymakers a glimpse into the oil industry.
We learned that the blowout preventer that the oil industry touted as fail-safe could, in fact, be sure to fail if an actual blowout was underway. We learned that the only technology the oil industry had been relying upon in the event of a spill was a Xerox machine. The spill response plans for major companies were so similar that they contained plans to evacuate walruses from the Gulf of Mexico, even though the walruses had not called the Gulf home in more than 3 million years.
But Democrats were never able to pass tighter safety regulations after the spill. And with Republicans now in charge in the House, it looks unlikely any new regulations will be coming soon. Instead, Democrats, including the president and congressional leaders, are trying a different tactic, renewing their effort to end tax breaks for the oil industry. Republicans, like Rob Bishop of Utah, say the oil industry doesn't get any special federal subsidies.
Every industry, manufacturing, producing, growing, extracting, gets a 9% of earned income deduction, not credit, except for oil and gas, where they are limited to just 6%.
Republicans say gas prices are so high in part because the U.S. is dependent on foreign oil. Bishop says the Democratic proposal is going to hamper the oil industry even further.
They then say, let's increase our production by raising taxes. What a non sequitur. Even if you raise taxes against somebody else and try to create some kind of straw man to attack, that's simply a non sequitur, because we do not have a tax problem in this country. We have a production problem. We have a jobs problem.
Republicans have been touting their plans to reduce the federal deficit of late, like overhauling Medicare and Medicaid. But while speaking on the House floor, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said a good place to start looking for more money is in the oil and gas industry.
If we ended those subsidies, we could save over $30 billion for the American people. To put it into context, my colleagues, for the first quarter of this year, the Big Five oil companies made profits of over $30 billion.
An analysis by the Nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation states that repealing the tax subsidies from the oil and gas industry won't drive energy prices up. Colorado Democratic Congressperson Jared Polis touted that report in the floor debate.
Again, when we talk about ending the giveaway to big oil and gas, it will have no effect with regard to actual energy prices.
Pelosi says she's not against increasing oil and gas exploration, but she says it needs to be included in a comprehensive energy bill.
And we must invest in our clean energy future, which will reduce our dependence on foreign oil, which is a national security issue, which will enable us to create new green jobs in our country.
An effort to repeal the tax breaks for the oil industry is increasing in the Senate, but it's unclear if it would be able to muster enough GOP support to get through that chamber or the House. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
16 House Democrats joined Republicans yesterday in approving H.R. 3, the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act. Opponents say the bill effectively stops even private coverage of abortion care and makes permanent the current annual ban on federal abortion funding known as the Hyde Amendment. Congressmember Gerald Nadler speaking Wednesday on the House floor.
This bill has been falsely advertised as a mere codification of existing law prohibiting federal funding of abortion. I've always opposed the unfair restrictions on federal funding for a perfectly legal health care procedure, but this bill goes far beyond prohibiting federal funding. The real purpose and effect of this bill is to eliminate private health care choices for women by imposing significant tax penalties on families and small businesses when they use their own money to pay for health insurance or medical care. This tax penalty is intended to drive insurance companies into dropping abortion services from existing private health care policies that women and families now have and rely upon.
The bill also prohibits the District of Columbia from using its local funds for abortions. After the bill passed, residents protested its passage, including D.C. Councilwoman Mary Che.
This is about democracy for D.C. This is about 600,000 people being able to decide for themselves how to govern themselves. It's about the citizens of D.C. getting the rights of every other citizen of the United States. And it's about us no longer being a colony, but being a real jurisdiction with real control.
The bill passed on a largely party-line vote of 251 to 175 and will likely be blocked by the Democrat-dominated Senate. President Obama has also indicated he would veto the bill. In South Florida, a battle is brewing between environmental activists and biotech company Scripps Florida over the last remaining forest land in eastern Palm Beach County. But as Kelly Benjamin reports, the fight is about much more than saving a piece of forest land from development.
In Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, drivers along Interstate 95 were recently treated to an interesting sight. Two people camped out 30 feet up in a pine tree with a banner reading, "Defend this forest."
We built the tree sit primarily as it was to serve as a deterrent to show the investors and the folks that had a stake in the Scripps Biotech project, to show them that there was a resistance building on the ground and that the cost for moving forward was going to be high.
That's Peniote Cholkis, an activist with Everglades Earth First, an organization that helped to halt the previous Scripps development in the environmentally sensitive area near Loxahatchee, Florida in 2005. Now Scripps hopes to move the project, phase two of their biotech city, to the Brigger Forest, a 680-acre parcel of pine flatwood forest next to Florida Atlantic University.
This habitat, really important endangered species habitat. It's pretty rare to find a forest like this east of I-95, in particular this eastern corridor, which is, you know, is home to scrub habitat, which is one of the most rare in all of Florida, along the Atlantic Coastal Ridge.
So in order to save this piece of forest from development, Earth First started a tree sit in February that lasted 5 weeks. While this form of environmental civil disobedience is common in threatened old-growth forests on the West Coast, it's almost unheard of in Florida.
The hardest part was coming down.
Yeah, definitely.
Rachel Kieski is an environmental activist with Everglades Earth First.
I spent a total of, I believe, 15 or 16 days being outside and being directly connected with nature and living right in trees. I mean, how many people get that opportunity and experience? It's incredible.
On March 21st, the Palm Beach Gardens Police Department shut down the tree sit. Police arrested two Earth First activists for trespassing, and they did something unexpected. They cut down the pine trees the activists were sitting in, as well as several other trees in the vicinity. Again, Paniote Cholkas.
They proceeded to brag about how they had cut trees, the trees at the other tree sit as well. At that point, we didn't know who had cut the trees.
The Palm Beach Gardens police refused to comment on the incident, but County Commissioner Karen Marcus says that it was the police chief and a city official who ordered the trees cut down.
The city of Palm Beach Gardens, that was their strategy to try to prevent it from happening. I found out about it after the fact. If they'd asked me in the beginning, I would have said, please don't chop the trees down. Yeah, I personally thought that was kind of dumb. For them to chop down the trees, I did call the assistant county administrator who authorized that and told her that I didn't want any more trees cut down.
Despite Commissioner Marcus's disappointment about the trees, she does defend the Scripps Biotech development in the Brigger Forest.
This property now has all of its development approvals. It's where development needs to occur if we're going to have development, not out west. It's on major highways. So it's a perfect fit for the spinoffs that will come to Palm Beach County. That property was going to get developed as something anyway, so now it's going to be biotech.
Advocates of the biotechnology industry in Florida see it as a way to jumpstart the state's sputtering economy. Since 2003, Florida taxpayers have invested over $1.5 billion in the biotech industry, creating just over 1,000 jobs. Some lawmakers in Tallahassee are beginning to question whether that investment is worth it. One of them is State Senator Gwen Margolis.
We put out about $1.5 billion over a period of 2 or 3 years to attract new biotech businesses into Florida. And the total result was about 1,100 jobs, something like that. And of the 1,200, Scripps was about 550, and they got over $500 million. It's the return on investment that I question.
There is also controversy surrounding the kind of biotechnology research Scripps is doing in Florida. Brian Tokar is the director of the Institute for Social Ecology and the author of several books on biotechnology.
Well, the whole mindset of biotechnology tries to first reduce our idea of what's important about life on Earth to sets of genetic sequences, and then subjects those genetic sequences to patent regulations and other limitations that further the process of commodifying life and also really ultimately end up impeding progress in medicine.
Meanwhile, back in Palm Beach County, Earth First is continuing their fight to save the Brigger Forest. On April Fool's Day, an activist in Joker-style face paint staged another tree sit in a pine tree directly in front of Palm Beach Garden City Hall. Authorities removed the protester with a crane, but this time, they decided not to cut the tree down. Kelly Benjamin, FSRN, Palm Beach Gardens, Florida.
And thanks to the community at Spot.us for contributing funding to Kelly's story. That's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.